From the shores of Puget Sound, this is Healthy Homecast. Healthy Homecast is created and operated by Healthy Painting and HealthyPainting.com. Healthy Homecast is your source for information, news, and events that focus on environmental responsibility, environmental consciousness, and eco-related products and practices. Find us on the web at www.healthyhomecast.com. And now your host, Daryl Whalen.
Okay, hello and welcome to Healthy Homecast. This is episode 9. I'm Daryl Whalen, and I'm usually here with Tony Freist, though tonight we're running solo. On the last episode, we had Doug Kennedy from Pathway Design and Construction. And on the next episode, we have Wendy Hughes-Jellin from Green Spaces Real Estate. We'll be back to meet this episode's guest, Stephen G. Gilbert, after we hear about some upcoming events in and around our area. Take it away. It's time for some healthy news, information, and events that are happening throughout the Puget Sound area. Sponsored by PigeonPointPC.com.
Okay, and welcome to the news. First up, we have the Seattle Green Festival taking place May 21st and 22nd at the Questfield Event Center. Green Festival is the event to attend to find the most authentic, environmentally and socially responsible products, practices, and information for anyone interested in green lifestyle and sustainable practices. Renowned keynotes, regional focus classes and workshops, local expert demonstrations and talks are complemented with activities and fun for every age and interest. The festival will feature Seattle's best local vegan and organic restaurants, Washington State's top organic beer makers and wine vineyards, cutting-edge cinema, all-day yoga, and movement classes, interactive cultural dance and music, and our biggest ever Green Kids Pavilion. Complement the largest eco-friendly marketplace of over 350 exhibitors. For more information, visit www.greenfestivals.org. Next up is the Low Sugar Jam. This is taking place June 4th, 2011 from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Finney Ridge Lutheran Church at 7500 Greenwood Avenue North in Seattle. Many jam recipes call for lots of sugars in order to ensure fruit preservation. But the outcome is not only unhealthy, it often obscures the true taste of fruit. This class will cover techniques to safely make low-sugar jams. In the process, you'll learn basic canning and jam-making techniques. Shannon Valderas is a Seattle TILF master and food preserver with many years of canning experience. Cost is $15 for members, $20 for non-members. Sign up through brown paper tickets, or send a check with class name and your contact information to City Fruit, P.O. Box 28577, Seattle, Washington, 98118, or visit www.cityfruit.org/classes.htm. And last but not least is the Port Townsend Green Building Symposium. This is taking place on June 4th, 2011 from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. in Port Townsend, Washington. If you're planning to build a new home or are interested in making your home more energy efficient, you won't want to miss this Green Building Symposium. The symposium will feature local architects, designers, and contractors who specialize in ultra-energy efficient building design and construction. Consultants who utilize thermal imaging techniques to calculate building heat loss in homeowners of innovative energy-efficient homes. The event will be sponsored by the Power Trip Energy Corp. A Port Townsend Solar PV contracting firm will be free and open to the public. For more information, contact Jeff Randall at 360-301-9019. That is the news, and now back to the podcast.
Please feel free to send any news, information, and events that focus on environmental consciousness and responsibility, as well as health, happiness, safety, and well-being, to info@healthyhomecast.com. And now, back to Healthy Homecast. Okay, thank you for that. We'll post those events on healthyhomecast.com along with this episode. So we're here, this episode guest, Stephen G. Gilbert. I originally met Steve at the Master Home Environmentalist training that I participated in about a year ago and that we've talked about on several episodes of this podcast. He's one of the educators in that program. His presentation and abundance of knowledge was incredibly inspiring as well as slightly intimidating. I told him then, if he may not recall, that I wanted to talk and meet with him, and he immediately obliged, and it's only taken about 12 months to do so. So I'm really happy to be here. Let's see, his resume and list of accomplishments is so long that I'd take an entire episode just to read it, so we'll just tell you a few things. Steve's a PhD in the DABT, and we're not sure what that is, but we're going to ask him about that once we get rolling. Director of Institute of Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders, affiliate professor at the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington, Seattle, and the Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences, University of Washington, Ballard. He's got no less than 15 books and publications to his credit, no less than 8 websites to his credit, and we'll find out what this stuff is and what it means during an interview and post as much of the info as possible on our website. So good evening, and please tell us in your own words who Stephen Gilbert is, what you do, where you do it, and why.
Daryl, thank you very much for having me on your program. This is really great. So, like you said, I'm a toxicologist, and my interest is in how we present information to the public. My view is we have tremendous amounts of knowledge, and we do a very good job presenting it to the public so we can individually make good decisions and collectively make good decisions. So I used to do a lot of research on lead and mercury, but now I run the institute, a small nonprofit institute, and our focus is putting scientific information in the context of history, society, and culture so people can make better decisions with this information. A lot of this information is under our foundation website, Toxipedia, and I published a book called A Small Dose of Toxicology, and recently formed a press called Healthy World Press, and we're publishing books that blend the arts and science to help people understand complex issues better.
Great. Yeah, we're going to talk about some of those things as we roll along. So how did you learn all of this?
You know, I've been working on these issues since 1976, where I started working on lead and mercury. And I was in health, actually in Canada, when I did a lot of that research, the Health Protection Branch, where we were trying to establish that low levels of lead and mercury exposure do affect the developing nervous system. I then moved from there to the University of Washington on the faculty there in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences. And there I learned that the university spent a lot of time learning more and more about less and less. And I felt like we learned all that stuff, but we weren't applying it, making good policy-related decisions. We didn't need to know more about lead and mercury to make good decisions to protect children's health. I left there and got involved in the biotech world, and I ran a company called BioSupport, where we did work on it for the pharmaceutical and biotech industries. And there I learned that the pharmaceutical and biotech industries are really focused on making money from disease. They're not interested in preventing disease. Mm-hmm. My real core interest is how do we prevent disease? How do we prevent and ensure that children, putting it in a positive way, that children can reach and maintain their full potential? And that doesn't happen when we expose them to lead, mercury, alcohol, all brominated flame retardants, PCBs, the plethora of chemicals we have in our environment. So what I wanted to do was ensure that children can reach and maintain their full potential.
Great. So you said 1976 was when you started the research or the education. What did you want to clarify that?
No, that's about right. I started research then and went back to school later on.
So we like to find out here on Healthy Homecast, what are one or more events or things that influence you to adopt this type of thing in your life in the first place?
I think there was no one event. My interest is very broad. And I felt like the central nervous system is very complex. And I was really interested in trying to figure out how do we protect the nervous system? How do we ensure our children can grow up and really use their brains and really understand the world around them? And I was also concerned that industry exploited the environment, exploited human health, and industries had a habit of externalizing the costs on the public. So I was very concerned about how we protect children, protect our families from exposure to chemicals, whether it's in our home or our workplace, and how do we guard against that? Because industry's out there to make money from whatever process they can, and they're not interested in preventing disease or protecting public health. So my interest is very much geared toward protecting human health and environmental health, too, and ecological health.
Well, it's all connected.
It is certainly all connected. And I think we miss sometimes how really interconnected it all is.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's exactly the focus of this podcast. So I feel really blessed to be able to have you participate in this. So keep in mind that we are a resource from everyone, from the very informed to the not so informed. What is a PhD?
So a PhD is you can pilot higher than deeper. That's what PhD stands for, pilot higher and deeper. So I went back to school for many years, so I could officially pilot higher and deeper. Now, in reality, you could go back to school for a long time and do some research to try to understand in depth. And like I mentioned before, universities are great for learning how to learn, you know, explore things in very great detail. You learn more and more about less and less. And I think we need to pull back from that a little bit and learn how to apply what we know. And, you know, I have those other initials after my name, too, the DABT part. And I joke that that's do all but toxicology. But in reality, that's for a diplomat of American Board of Toxicology. So it's jumping through more hoops of getting more recognition for your knowledge about toxicology.
I was going to actually ask you about the DABT things next. So we actually have a diplomat.
We have a diplomat here.
Here on the podcast. Well, that's...
Board certified diplomat.
Board certified. Awesome. So we kind of touch on the esoteric a little bit here on the Healthy Homecast. I was wondering, is there anybody or anything in your life that's that you're connected to that has helped you with your successes in general in your life?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I think the person that has been most a mentor for me is when the guy at the University of Rochester, a guy named Bernie Weiss, and he's been a real inspiration to me. He's in his 80s now, and he's still out there working. I just co-authored a paper with him on lead in 2006, and he is really an inspiring guy, very far-thinking, forward-thinking individual that looks beyond where he is at the moment. He's in some ways, he's not very good at the here and now, you know, and helping you with your current problem, but thinking about the future and where things are going. He's brilliant. So I think he has been a really fantastic influence. And I was also heavily influenced on the nonviolence issues by Gandhi and Martin Luther King. I think those would be my two other major heroes, would be how we move forward in a society in nonviolent ways and try to change society and really be the change we want to see.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much. That's exactly how I feel. It's neat to be, all of us have people in our lives that are an inspiration. Yeah. I think it's really important to touch on that and communicate that when we do this kind of stuff. So what is your role as a director?
So I'm director of the Institute for Neurotoxicology and Neurological Disorders, and we found this nonprofit about 15 years ago or so. So we did more research when we first got it going, but in the last 5 to 10 years or so, we really focus on policy-related issues. How do we change the rules and regulations? How do we institute more a safer environment, safer things for our children? So we work a lot on issues at the state level, and we work to help pass laws to limit brominated flame retardants, try to protect children's health by limiting cadmium phthalates and lead in children's toys, and most recently work on trying to eliminate bisphenol A from baby bottles. So we did a lot of work on that, and like I mentioned before, our real goal is to provide information to the public, try to put sound scientific information out to the public in our websites, talk about the issues, and try to help people understand the consequences of chemical exposure in our lives.
Is this a nonprofit organization, or is this a public utility, or
It's a nonprofit organization in the technical IRS parlance. It's 501c3, so we are. You can donate to us if you'd like to do that, but... We're a very nonprofit. In the last few years, we joke we survived on rejection. You know, we put a lot of grants out there, And we have a number of different projects. We have gotten some funding from different organizations to set up our different websites that focus on a variety of issues.
Great. So what is your role as an affiliate professor?
So my role at the University of Washington, I'm very lucky to be involved with the university. And after I left, I maintained my affiliate status. I do some teaching there. I just, in the last week or so, I just taught a number of lectures in the department there to graduate students about toxicology, mostly on metals. So I do some of that. And a couple years ago, I taught a full course on risk assessment, which tries to look at the health effects of different chemicals and evaluate how safe they are. So I collaborate still with my colleagues, and I write papers with them and co-author chapters and books. So, and it, you know, I have access to University of Washington libraries, and it's really a great relationship. I love the academic environment, and I probably wouldn't mind being back. I love teaching, doing more teaching, but there are a bunch of restrictions that come with it because University of Washington faculty are technically employees of the state, so they end up getting tangled up in some rules about testifying in Olympia. And I do a testify in Olympia and very much engaged in policy issues, which would run afoul of some of the ethical rules at the University of Washington.
Yeah, I get that. So what is the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences? What is it all about? What do they do? What's their purpose?
So at the University of Washington, the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences is part of the School of Public Health. And they have a toxicology program that does research. One area is very much interested in molecular biology. So a lot of that explores how compounds are metabolized. So we're exposed to pesticides, and some of us metabolize them really well. Some people don't metabolize them well. And trying to understand why that's the case, what enzymes, what molecules in the body aid or retard metabolism of chemicals. So that's one thing they explore. There's also people exploring the effects of bromate and flame retardants on fish and their health effects of different chemicals. There's an occupational health unit that works on exposure in the workplace. And, they run trying to work on labor and industry issues, trying to understand how do we make a better workforce, a safer workforce. And there's another program called on continuing education, reaching out to the public.
And then what about... Yeah, we'll have to make sure that we bring up the RRP at some point, being I'm a painting contractor, and that's like does with lead and stuff.
Right.
What about the Department Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences? What's that all about?
So it's University of Washington Bothell, actually, is where that is. So the University of Washington Seattle campus, there's also Tacoma and then the Bothell campus. And I did some teaching up there. I was on their advisory board for a number of years, and I taught some courses on ethics at the University of Washington Bothell campus, and I'm a member of the Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences program, which is a really neat program because it has science, but also looks at societal impact of that science. And like I said, I was teaching courses on ethics. How do we marry the science? How do we explore decision-making from an ethical standpoint? Like one of my ethics is that for environmental health is that all children should be able to reach, maintain their full potential. They should have an environment that allows that. And I think it's a quote-unquote the adults of society, we have a responsibility to ensure our children have an environment like that. So we explored issues like that. We explored issues like research issues around ethics. What kind of testing can you do on humans or animals? How do we explore that? How do we think about the decision-making process around studies like that?
No. Yeah, I remember when you were teaching at the Master Home Environmentalist, there was so much information that you have, and it was coming out so fast that I darn near burned out my pen.
And in some of that, I talked about the ethics in that course, too.
That was fantastic. So are there a lot of people in the world that do this kind of stuff?
Well, there is quite a few, actually. There's a meeting called the Society of Toxicology, a big international organization that has a meeting every year, and they attract about 8,000 toxicologists. And toxicology, there's a range of disciplines within toxicology. You've got your scientists in the academic community. You've got people in the pharmaceutical and biotech industry that are looking at the health effects of chemicals, making sure that the drugs are safe when they go to market. There's people in the government that work on these issues that help put forward regulation. They might regulate the amount of lead exposure or mercury, put up guidelines, put up fish advisories for mercury. They might regulate how we are exposed to bromate and flame retardants. So people, in a whole range of areas in toxicology, I think that's one thing that attracted me to toxicology. You can go a long way, all kinds of places with it, and I take it a different direction with my websites.
Yeah, there's got to be so much politics and power and money and stuff and involved in this conversation about toxicology. Just listening to you, it just has me thinking about all that.
There's a huge amount. One of the big issues right now is TSCA reforms. So that's the Toxic Substance Control Act. And a bill is just ready to be introduced at a national level about trying to give the Environmental Protection Agency at the national level more authority to regulate chemicals. And at the state level, there was a bill put forward in the last session trying to regulate chemicals. It was defeated, but that would have given the State Department of Ecology more authority to remove hazardous chemicals without going through a complicated rulemaking process. But we need to have a better policy to protect human health, and we have a right to know what we're being exposed to, which our current laws do not allow for that. They give, in my view, too much emphasis on the business community to make money from the process and not have a mandate to protect human and environmental health.
Yeah, I just see that, you know, I asked myself, is this always going to be like an issue, a debate? I guess, is that part of the human condition or?
I think we've made this problem ourselves in some ways. We've made the problem because we've given corporations personalities. We've given them too much authority. Some decisions, recent decisions by the Supreme Court have given corporations the right to almost be person and given them some rights as personhood. And I think that's a huge mistake. And corporations, their big responsibility is to make money for their shareholders. And that's at the disregard of human environmental health. They have no responsibility to human environmental health. Their responsibility is to make money for their shareholders. And I think that fundamentally needs to change, that we just cannot continue on this course where we give corporations the right to externalize their costs. They put the costs out on the public. The best example is tobacco industry. But the tobacco industry for years and years has put out a product that we know causes cancer and cardiovascular disease, just to name a couple. And we, as the citizens of this country, pay for that in healthcare costs, while the corporations take all the profits from the cigarettes. And that's just wrong. We've got to have a different system about this.
Oh, boy. That's like an understatement. You know, one of the things that when we put this podcast together and put the whole concept together, we wanted to make sure that we tried to hold back on being too judgmental and making other people wrong or bad. But, you know, in certain things, in certain areas like this, I find myself having quite amount of difficulty in doing so. I mean,
yeah, I think I've got increasingly more. It's tough when you see what some of these corporations get away with. Not to say that capitalism is horrible. You know, I think it just has some regulatory limits on it because it cannot be a race to the bottom. But we need to have a level playing field so there's a certain set of rules that help protect human and environmental health, and within those rules allow capitalism to work.
Yeah, you wonder, I mean, not you, but I mean myself, I wonder if, do people really not get this whole human and environmental and animal impact with, you know, with all the toxic stuff that we put in there? Is there really not an issue here? Am I like naive, or is there not really a problem here, or what's the deal?
I think that people are starting to recognize it's a problem and that we're exposed to a lot of chemicals. Take bisphenol A, for example. It's used in plastics to harden plastics, and the vast majority of us excrete bisphenol A in our urine, and none of us gave consent to be exposed to this chemical, and it's a low-level endocrine disruptor. And why is that the case? And I think people are starting to think about this stuff. They recognize their babies should not be exposed to bisphenol A in their baby bottles. And they're going, you know, what is this all about? I thought the government was protecting us from this. In reality, the government's not. Mm-hmm. They have supported an industry. Bisphenol A is produced at 7 billion pounds per year. And that, without doing the safety check, without ensuring its safety, without understanding or really thinking through the consequences of that exposure and making sure it's safe for all of us. So I think people are starting to think more about this, but at the same time, we're all very busy people, and we can't keep downloading the burden onto average consumers. We can't give them the responsibility of sorting through this information.
So you say that there's other people that are doing this kind of stuff in life and throughout the world. How does what you do or how you do it differ from others?
You know, there's many different approaches to this. In Seattle area, we have a number of organizations that work very hard on changing policy. The Washington Toxics Coalition is one of those. People for Puget Sound. There's a number of groups, American Lung Association, that are working hard to help people understand the consequence of exposure and working on policy, changing rules and laws in Olympia. So my organization really works on the information and educational aspect. We have a number of, like, for example, you can go and download PowerPoint presentations, 1 and 2 day toxicology courses, and we try hard to put information in the context of history, society, and culture, not just throwing science on the wall, giving a lot of science facts, but really trying to put it in context of our everyday lives, a little bit of context with history, so you can see that we've known about this stuff. Like lead, we knew lead was a hazard 2,000 years ago, that lead makes the mind give way. And why are we still sorting out the health consequences of lead? So we try to work on issues like that, trying to put this information, toxicological information, in a context of everyday lives.
So is there anything that you'd like people in general or your students or other faculty to know or understand about what you do or the line of work that you're in that they may not be aware of already?
I think that the thing that I would like them to think about is the ethical aspects of what we do. I think we get caught up in the science, and I think that all of us need to think about our ethical responsibilities to future generations. And I think that point gets missed out. And even I think we don't do a good job of really exploring that aspect of things, that we need to be thinking about the future generations and what are the consequences of our actions now, both the health of our children but also in our grandchildren and future generations after that. We've got to be thinking through these issues. We got, for example, with nuclear power, we need to be thinking what the consequences of generating those highly contaminated spent fuel rods are, because the future generations are going to be taking care of those things. Do we want to pass them on to future generations? What are we doing about the wildlife? Are we ensuring, for example, we have a solid stock of tuna? Are we just going to fish tuna into the ground? And I think we need to manage the environment better than we're doing now.
That's an understatement. So regarding ethics and responsibility, you say that you don't do as good of a job as perhaps you could, but what methods do you do use to communicate these things right now, aside from stuff like this?
Things like this. I try to emphasize in the talks I give. I usually start my talks off a little about ethics. We have a section on our website called Ethical Considerations. We've tried to do that where we try to put in presentations, talk about different aspects of ethics. But it's sort of down on the right-hand side, down toward the bottom. So it's not like we feature it often. I think we need to feature ethics. I think we need to talk more about a precautionary approach to making decisions. And our whole decision-making process needs to change around putting health and human health and environmental health as a priority versus making the fast buck off of things. So we need to sort of rethink some of our decision-making process. And that's, you know, a much more complex issue than just presenting a bunch of science and facts about science. So we need to do more thinking about how do we integrate those, the science and the facts, into ethics.
So please tell us what your personal mission statement might be and or that of your titles that you hold and what that means to the world in general.
So my personal mission, I've mentioned this before, would be to ensure that we have an environment where our children can reach, maintain their full potential.
Beautiful.
And that's sort of my touchstone. Are my actions contributing to that? And the websites that I've put up and the people I collaborate with, I try to make that the cornerstone. Are we trying to create an environment where children, and I mean children of all species, you know, that the salmon can get upstream, they're not exposed to copper, they're not exposed to dams, so the salmon can reach and maintain their potential, the whales, almost all creatures, because humans are now, like it or not, basically in charge of the whole life of the world. Our lives, lives of all the plants and animals, we're driving many to extinction. We're destroying the fishing grounds, many creatures. And how do we think about this, that we are creating an environment? What environment are we creating that has sustainable for future generations? And ensuring not just sustainable, but that people can reach, maintain their potential, that we are creating people who are not harming your ability to think, learn, and remember. And that's the touchstone of all the work I do.
Beautiful. What is your definition of human environmental health?
Well, that comes back to, you know, in that place where children in particular are not exposed to lead, not exposed to mercury, not exposed to brominated flame retardant, and they have an environment that's enriching, that has proper nutrition, they have good training, they have good schooling, good education, they have a real social infrastructure, they have parents to care for them, that they are able to really move forward in life, and that we are supporting those that don't have the best opportunities. And I think we, unfortunately, I see our society moving away from some of that, and we need to come back to recognizing that everybody has a right to an environment that is clean, that has few toxins as possible, and we know what's what's in our environment and what we're exposed to, and we can protect ourselves from those things.
You mentioned before, can you talk a little bit more about what does caffeine tell us about toxicology?
So caffeine, I'm glad you brought that up, Daryl. So caffeine's a very fun drug. I assume many of your listeners have consumed caffeine before, and I would say, and how many of you have felt the effects of caffeine, you know, a little jitter you get, and you've consumed too much caffeine? And then you have to think about what happens when you stop drinking caffeine. And some of your listeners will say, oh, I get a headache when I stop drinking it. That's really interesting, because then you can't stop drinking caffeine. And you're looking at the toxicological properties. So if you felt the effects of too much caffeine, you're a neurotoxicologist. You felt the effects. What's interesting about caffeine is you can feel the effects. You don't feel the effects of lead or PCBs or mercury right away, but caffeine, we can feel the effects of that. And the other thing about caffeine, it distributes throughout total body water. So you drink a cup of caffeine, it really goes quickly throughout your total body water. So when you go to the bathroom, your urine will have the same concentration in your blood supply of caffeine. Another thing to think about is caffeine has a relatively short half-life, and that means how fast you metabolize caffeine. So if you get your blood caffeine levels, say, up to a level of 10, how long does it take to drop to 5? And you can ask yourself a little bit about that and say, well, how long before I want my second cup of coffee, before my blood caffeine levels will drop down and I need to boost them back up again? And the half-life of caffeine is about 4 to 5 hours for most people. If you're a smoker, it's going to be shorter. So most smokers drink more caffeine than others do. So it's got a fairly short half-life. So think about the properties that we've just described. So caffeine's got a pretty short half-life. You can't drink too much at any one time because you get the jitters, and when it drops down, you have to go back and get more. You can't stop drinking because you get headache. You almost couldn't design a better drug to make money from the caffeine, unless, of course, it's nicotine. A couple other really interesting properties about caffeine. The first 6 months of life, you don't metabolize it. So your half-life is measured in days. So as an infant, you can't metabolize caffeine. So it's best if you're a mom and breastfeeding your child to drink caffeine after breastfeeding, not before, because your breast milk will have about the same amount of caffeine as your blood supply will. So you want to limit the caffeine going into kids. Kids is very small, so even a small amount of exposure to caffeine means a big dose. And the other thing, during pregnancy, what's really interesting is the half-life of caffeine lengthens. So during the second and third trimesters, the half-life of caffeine is 7 or 8 hours, so the metabolism slows down. So you consume caffeine, it'll have higher caffeine levels for a longer period of time. And those are the lessons of toxicology with a drug. Where does it go in the body? Caffeine goes throughout total body water. How long's the half-life? How quick is it metabolized? And what are the health effects associated with it? So caffeine's got many lessons. I love talking about caffeine. It's a good drug. I'm not saying anybody should stop drinking it, but you just need to be aware of its properties and why it's such a great moneymaker.
It's a much safer example than, for instance, nuclear fallout.
Much safer.
What's the half-life of nuclear waste?
Yeah, well, you know, that varies. You know, iodine-131, which comes out, has a half-life of about 8 days. Cesium's, I think, about 24 days or so. So they have different toxicity. It lasts for a longer period of time. And that sort of goes with a lot of the other compounds. Lead, for example, has a half-life in the body of about 30 days, so it drops down. So that's how long a compound sticks around.
Wow. So what is, you were talking about children. Why are children more susceptible to the effects of chemicals?
That's a great question. My comeback with that is our children are not little adults. So children are more susceptible, and there's a number of reasons for that. For example, with lead, children absorb about 50% of the lead they ingest because lead substitutes for calcium. Kids are growing. Their bodies are growing rapidly. They need a lot of calcium. So they absorb the calcium, and their body is seeking out that calcium. Adults, in contrast, only absorb about 10% of the lead they ingest. So right there, that a given exposure to lead, the kids are more susceptible because they're going to absorb more of that lead. Lead goes to developing nervous system. The nervous system's more susceptible to the effects of lead. Lead incorporates in that calcium. It ends up in the bone of children. So that's really detrimental because as they get older, that lead could be moved out of the bone, particularly for young girls when they're pregnant. They mobilize the lead out of their bones and that lead and the calcium out of their bones. So that lead and calcium ends up going into the fetus. So again, there's more susceptibility. And I think the susceptibility of kids, alcohol is another good example where the consumption of alcohol during pregnancy causes fetal alcohol syndrome. And that really needs to be avoided. That's the most preventable form of mental retardation in the world. So again and again, you look at kids, they're more susceptible, they're smaller size. For any given exposure, a child has a bigger dose because dose is measured in body weight. So it's relative to body weight. You're exposed to a certain exposure. You take caffeine, for example. A cup of coffee has about 100 milligrams of caffeine. And a cup of soda has about 50, say. So you give a child 50 milligrams of caffeine. It's much different than giving 50 milligrams of caffeine to an adult. So you always have to be thinking kids are more vulnerable, more susceptible to health effects of almost any exposure.
Yeah, and that's when I first met Eileen Gagne and then got involved with the Master Home Environmentalist Program, I think that's pretty much one of the first and probably one of the most powerful and important parts of that whole thing is that the immune system isn't developed yet, and it's not just about caffeine and alcohol and all that stuff. It's about pretty much every single thing that we have in our home, and it might not affect us as adults, but the kids are just getting bombarded with everything.
Yeah, kids are getting bombarded. There's been some studies looking at cord blood where the study by Environmental Working Group showed that there were 200 chemicals found in cord blood that a child's being exposed to during development. So in Washington Toxics Coalition did a couple studies like that too where they look at exposure during pregnancy and they looked at urine, blood, and hair levels. And we're exposed to a whole bunch of chemicals. As we age, we become almost like toxic waste dumps, walking toxic waste dumps of all the chemicals we're exposed to. And most of us have not given consent to expose to these chemicals. They just come along with the products we use, with the food we eat, and just our general living, the air we breathe, the water we drink.
Except for, never mind that. Let's see. So this is a question you gave me, and I don't even quite understand it, but I'm going to ask you.
Uh-oh.
The CDC sets blood levels at 10 UD/D as an action level. What? My goodness, so, is that? And then let me know if that's adequate or not.
That was close. The Center for Disease Control sets a blood lead action level. So how much lead is in blood and when you should take an action. So it's set at 10 micrograms per deciliter. So if a child, for example, has a blood lead above 10 micrograms per deciliter, you should take action to reduce lead exposure. And that is very serious. I mean, you have a blood lead above 10, and that is detrimental to the child's ability to learn and remember. Now, the reason I asked you to ask that question, because it's very important to understand that there's no safe level of lead exposure. The average blood lead's now down around 1.3, 1.6 micrograms per deciliter. My own argument is that any exposure, any blood lead above 2 is detrimental to a child's health, and we should be exploring where that lead is coming from. There's now a whole body of data showing that if you take your blood lead from 2 to 10, you lose more IQ points than when your blood lead goes from 10 to 20. So again, showing the very exquisite sensitivity to developing nervous system to that early exposure. And this has been a chronic lesson in toxicology. The more we study, the more we recognize that very low levels of exposure has detrimental effects. There was just a paper that came out very recently that showed that exposure in those early years, the 1 to 3 years of age, you have the highest blood lead usually when you're growing up. And that has detrimental effects when you turn into your 20s. You have brain imaging scans show there's changes in the brain associated with your lead exposure when you're an infant. So this is just an example that the consequences of exposure. And I think the other reason that's a very interesting thing is because it shows where science and policy come together. So we've got science saying that blood lead levels down to 2 are detrimental, and we've got a policy statement that's saying, 10 microgram per deciliter, that's when you need to take action. I wrote a paper in 2006 that argued that we need to change that so that we need to have action at 2. Any child with blood lead above 2, we should be taking some kind of action to understand where that lead's coming from and reducing that lead exposure. That's a long-winded answer, but I think a really important example in our society that needs to change.
Yeah, well, it's great for me to hear that kind of stuff because, well, I did hear it before in your class, but I was too much for you to remember. But hearing it again, especially as I mentioned earlier, being a painting contractor for a long time and having this new this RRP lead ruling come up over the last couple of years and seeing how other contractors react to it. And when I have conversations with clients and stuff around it, it's kind of interesting because it's like sort of like out of sight, out of mind. As long as it's not affecting anybody that you know and everything, it's, you know, why is it more work and more money to now try and, you know, try to take care of something that has been broken and poisoned and stuff over years. And so that's great pieces of information.
And it is. And you don't see the immediate effects of that lead exposure. You as a painter were probably exposed to lead while you're working in some of those old homes because the United States did not ban lead-based paint until 1978. And I want to point out that Europe, the League of Nations, banned lead-based paint in the 1920s.
Wow.
Because they recognized that lead was harmful, caused the mine give way, and they took a very precautionary approach. If we had gotten lead out of our paint in the 1920s, we would not be having so many problems right now of lead exposure to children. And having this RRP rule and all the efforts going into that, it's really a tragedy in some ways that we did not look at the science and look at the data. And we've repeated that mistake again and again. You know, we've got to look forward and think about the consequence of what we're doing and not put so much, in this case, lead onto the walls of our homes where our children end up being exposed to it.
So why is mercury in fish?
So that's another really interesting question. So mercury, you know, it's a naturally occurring metal. And sure, many of your listeners have played with mercury. You know, it's a very fun thing to play with. You know, it moves around. It comes back together again. But mercury evaporates. At room temperature, it evaporates. One of the few metals that's a liquid at room temperature, but it evaporates. When it evaporates, it gets into the water system. And when it gets into the water system, bacteria turn it into methyl mercury. So you've gone from an inorganic metallic mercury into an organic mercury. And then inorganic or organic mercury that moves up the food chain. So it bioconcentrates and bioaccumulates up the food chain into the fish we consume. So it's very detrimental to us as humans when we eat that. Mercury is incorporated into the muscle of fish. And the FDA has rules about that. So the high-level fish like tuna, swordfish, shark will have high mercury content in them. And we need to limit that. So some restrictions about trying to limit mercury consumption, particularly for women of childbearing age and children. And we put mercury in the environment from a whole variety of sources. One of the biggest ones is coal-fired utility plants. So coal has mercury in it. You burn the coal, goes up the stack, out into the environment, contaminates the lakes. It's been a huge problem in eastern United States. The prevailing winds go from west to east, and the Adirondacks in New York gets the mercury that came out of Ohio in these coal-fired utility plants. So in Washington State, we had one coal-fired plant, Centralia, down in Centralia, the TransAlta plant, which is now going to be shut down in 2025. And that plant put out over 300 pounds of mercury per year, way more than enough to contaminate many of the lakes in our area. Mm-hmm. And right now, because of China burning coal in mass quantities, Washington State and really the West Coast receives the air coming from China. So our mercury levels have actually gone up because of coal being burned in China. So we need to be thinking, forward thinking again, do we want to ship coal from Montana and put in these shipping terminals, ships coal to China to be burned and comes back to us. Now, the real tragedy about this is that we know how to stop mercury going up the smokestacks, but the coal-fired utility plants aren't interested in putting pollution control devices on their plants because they don't make any money from doing that. They only make money from generating electricity. They want to put another boiler in, another electric generating turbine, so they want to generate more electricity because that makes money for their shareholders. So the only way to fix that is there needs to be rules set up by our society run by the government, that says you have to control the mercury effluent from your plants. And our electricity may cost a little more, but we have to stop externalizing the cost of doing electricity production onto women and children.
Yeah, I was going to say, China, also Mexico. Doesn't Mexico City burn
a lot of pollution, air pollution down there is terrible. They use leaded gasoline for a long time.
Yeah, you know, to touch on the politics thing, just a hair, I hear about all these people talking about how much there's too much politics and there's too much regulation. Could you imagine if we broke down. the political system is challenging as it is right now. It would be complete and utter chaos.
I think it'd be horrible. You know, I do tend to drift into the politics a little bit, but I think that's where toxicology takes you, because you are looking at the health effects of chemicals. And you're right. I mean, I think that some of the things going on with trying to limit the spending with the EPA, I'm really, you know, the Lisa Jackson, who's head of the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S., is a fantastic appointment. And we need to be thinking about this. Climate change is also another one that needs to be more thought out. What are the consequences of continuing to roll up our carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere? And global warming is a fact. And to deny the science around these issues is just appalling to me as a scientist. And we need to be thinking about future generations, the consequences of this. To roll back the regulations we had, you go back and look at the 20s and 30s, people want to go back to the 50s even, and you had rivers catching fire. People forget this. You know, we just saw the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, where over 100 women, young women, died because they locked the doors to a factory and they were jumping out the windows and dying because they were seamstress making clothing. And we were exploiting that. And now we're doing the same thing. We're seeing that same thing happen in developing countries.
Yeah, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I don't know if you know, like back in the 60s, their river caught on fire because it was so polluted.
I was thinking of that.
That was my hometown.
Amazing. Did you see it catch fire?
No, but I mean, I was.
Yeah.
But I mean, I lived there, and I was. Right. I think it was in the late 60s.
It was.
So yeah, that's crazy.
The Nora, Pennsylvania had a. There's a great book by Deborah Davis that talked about when smoke ran like water, where the steel industry and the coke industry had just a horrible mess. People died from exposure to and asthma and exposure to the particles in the air. We've come a long way in cleaning up the environment, and I hate to see us roll that back where air pollution, you know, water pollution, and just rolling some of the rules and regulations back and some of the transparency that we need to control these things.
Yeah, that's wow, what a something. So what is the precautionary principle?
So the precautionary principle is really, and I think, a very important approach to decision making. It may not be the answer, but in rough words, it says do no harm. So really, it says don't harm things. You know, be cautious about things. And it also says that we have a certain amount of science and to take action in the face of uncertainty. So the precautionary principle says even if you're not totally positive of the health effects of something, err on the side of caution. So right now, we have a society that expects us to show the burden is on us to demonstrate harm, not on industry to demonstrate safety. For example, you put out a product on the marketplace, and I'll tell you another example. Let me back up for a second. The Food and Drug Administration, where we put a new drug on the market, the Food and Drug Administration has a very precautionary approach to putting drugs on the market. So the pharmaceutical or biotech industry has to show efficacy, that the product is doing what it's supposed to do, and safety, that we understand the toxicity, we understand the side effects, we understand the potential harms. Thalidomide, for example, is a chemical that came out in the 60s that caused teratogenic effects, that foreshortening the arms, in utero exposure to that chemical really harmed the fetus. Mm. And we came out with a whole bunch of laws that gave the Food and Drug Administration authority to regulate drugs on the market. We don't have a similar approach to regulating industrial chemicals. There's roughly 3,000 chemicals produced over 1 million pounds per year, and we know very little about most of the health effects. And what we do know, we are not allowed to see because the industry claimed it's confidential business information. So the precautionary principle says, even in the face of uncertainty, take preventive action. Cigarette smoking is an example of that, where the industry clouded over the issue of whether cigarettes really cause cancer. For years, they said you couldn't prove it. That's ridiculous. You know, we knew that cigarettes are harmful, and we need to take a precautionary approach, limit advertising, restrict the giveaway of cigarettes, things like that. We need to take the same approach to industrial chemicals. We need to put the burden of responsibility on those that are making money and stop the externalization of costs onto the public, particularly our children.
That sounds like crazy socialism talk.
Might be a little bit in that direction.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, it's all about, yeah. But anyhow, we don't want to go there. Let's see. So I assume that we probably have no idea what chemicals and stuff are in our consumer products, or most of them. And what if that is the case, why is that so?
You know, unfortunately, we don't. You know, you take your fragrances, many of our cosmetics, we don't know all the ingredients in those things. And one of the ingredients of cosmetics is phthalates, for example. Phthalates carry fragrances. You do your dryer sheets or your bathroom deodorizers, those things, outgas fragrances and phthalate chemicals, your rubber sheet, you know, your shower curtains that are plastic shower curtains, that plastic smell, that's related to the phthalates that are outgassing from that product. And we're not informed about that stuff. There's no requirement that they have to tell us what ingredients are in these products. And I think we should know what our products are. Oil dispersants that we use in a Gulf oil, when that oil disaster down there, they used millions of gallons of dispersant. For quite a long time, we were not given the knowledge to know what chemicals made up those oil dispersants. So I think that's wrong. Pesticides are another one. We do a lot of work on what the active ingredients of pesticides are, but pesticides have enormous number of carrying agents, and they're called, euphemistically called, inert ingredients. And we're not told what those ingredients are. So we have, I think, a right to know what we're being exposed to, what chemicals in our cosmetics, our healthcare products, you know, our cosmetics, our cleaning agents in our houses. We should know what is in there, what proportions are in there, and be able to make informed decisions as consumers. Industry doesn't want to do that because they say it's confidential business information, that they're taking some kind of competitive advantage, and they don't want to release that because their competitors are going to get a hold of that information and somehow make more money from it. And I think that's the wrong emphasis. We're too big a society. We've got too many products on the market. Too many of this stuff's going down the drain. Too much of it's getting in the environment, that we need to know what's in these products. The industry needs to be accountable for that. And they need to also, I just want to make one more point here, take back the products they make. Take back our computers. They manufacture them. They should take them back. Because this e-waste gets over into developing countries, gets dismantled by kids in developing countries and harms their health. We need to take responsibility for the products we produce.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to somebody, like a computer person that knows about that
stuff. Great.
Yeah. Wow. I think, isn't it true that... Is it safe to say that sometimes the inert ingredients can actually be more damaging and harmful than the ones that are actually publicized on the container?
Yeah, I think they can be. You know, you have to really be cautious of that. You know, a lot of them are petroleum-based products, and we don't know what they are, you know, in most cases. Yeah. You know, the government and I know what they are, but they're restricted on releasing that stuff. So they may cause asthma. They may cause, headache or something like that, independent of the active ingredient in these products. We just don't know. And even, you know, the dryer sheets, some people can very sensitive to that chemical sensitivity from these products. And one person at the University of Washington tried to reverse engineer these products and figure out what is in some of these materials. And a lot of carcinogenic agents in it. And we just need to think twice about doing that. And industry needs to tell us what's in these products. The Environmental Working Group website's got a big thing on cosmetics where they've tried to back engineer some of the stuff and try to list the ingredients. So that's an important step, but why do we have to go to all that work? Why can't we just be informed about what's in these products?
So, you know, it's a little bit of asthma is a small price to pay for some some pretty smelling pillowcases.
Yeah, particularly for our kids, right?
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, Steve. I think we've so far almost gone as long as we've had on any other episode, and I don't even think we're like halfway through. So we're going to take a little bit of a break here,
okay.
And we'll be right back with Healthy Homecast.
You are listening to Healthy Homecast.
Gravity connects me to the earth, which connects me to people who connect me to myself more honestly. And gravity connects me to the crust, which connects to the leaves on the trees that make it possible to breathe. Came to rest on the minefield, blessed with naive mind shield. Like a helmet, they would tell us that we don't know how we feel or how to connect with other people on the planet. Oh, if we only knew the power in each blue disillusioned little.
Okay, we're back, and here, let's see, once again, we're here at the Healthy Homecast, and we're here with Steve Gilbert, and we're on episode 9, so we're still waiting to truck in that applause machine for all the excitement. But so we're going to pick up where we left off. And when I got the information about yourself. I saw a lot of different written type of stuff that you were involved in, and I started to decipher it, and I figured I probably wouldn't get it done by the time the show started up. So I just decided to ask you to tell us about some of your publications, books. You mentioned journals and book chapters and consensus statements and stuff. Why don't you talk about a little bit about that stuff?
No, thank you. That's a great introduction to. I think it's very important to put information out there. When I stopped working with industry, I wrote the book Small Dose of Toxicology. And I really wanted that to be an introductory book. I had in the back of my mind to write that. And actually, part of the germination came from the Master Home Environmentalist Program. I thought there needed to be a book that just explained in chapter by chapter a little bit about different chemicals. So there's chapters on caffeine and nicotine and pesticides and basic toxicology chapters. And on the website, I put up information so you can download a PowerPoint presentation for each chapter. So I really wanted to make it something that you could easily learn from. You don't even have to buy the book. You can just look at the PowerPoint chapters or PowerPoint slides and sort of get a feeling for what the information is all about. So it's really an effort to make information accessible. And then I've continued to write. I mentioned that review paper we did on lead, arguing why the Center for Disease Control should lower blood lead action levels from 10 to 2. And we've published other papers. One of them we worked on was this consensus statement that you mentioned. So that was the Learning Disabilities Association. So we put together a paper that has almost 200 references in it that looked at chemicals that cause neurodevelopmental disorders, that cause disorders that affect the child's ability to learn, think, and remember, affects their IQ in a broad way. And we looked at different chemicals that might affect that, some we were sure about, some we were not so sure about, and called for different research and more research. And so worked on projects like that. Our biggest project has been our websites, where we've tried to make information accessible. Toxipedia is a foundation website for that. So it's a wiki-based site that we collect articles about different toxicants, and we try to weave them together to put the information in the context of history, society, and culture. So we've got a large foundation material, many different chemicals we looked at, as well as luminaries and toxicology. We've got a big teaching resources section on that, a whole bunch of stuff on history. We have we did this project where we put together posters, and the posters are PDF files you can download, and you can click on the area of the poster and get more information. So we have a big one on milestones of toxicology where you can run across this poster and get more information about historical effects of toxicology. We've also started a number of other websites up. If you want me to go into that,
we're going
to
go through those actually in a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
I could talk a long time about those. So we continue to work and publish and do more writing and trying to get the word out about this and conduct interviews. I still do some teaching at the University of Washington and run 1 and 2 day toxicology courses. All that material is up on the website. So you can actually go to Toxipedia and download a 1 day toxicology course and go teach it, which I encourage your listeners to do. You can just download a whole, actually there's a 2 day toxicology course also.
Cool. Well, you've touched on some of this a little bit, but we're going to bring them up again a little bit. Let's take one of these. Let's take all of these, actually, one at a time. And please tell us what the intended role of each of these. These are all your websites and stuff that you're involved in. So we want to know about the intention of these things.
Okay.
So we'll start out with the small dose of toxicology, which is asmalldoseof.org. And before you get started on that, we're going to let you know that all of this, or if not most of this stuff, will be on the Healthy Homecast site when Steve's episode or episodes, as it may be, are uploaded.
No, thank you. So asmalldoseof.org is a website that supports the book, A Small Dose of Toxicology. And each chapter of the book is supported by a section on that website that has references in it that you can click and get more information about the subject. For example, with caffeine or lead, you have a lot of references, plus the base material, the introduction to the subject matter, and also that PowerPoint presentation. You can teach material on it. It has information about precautionary principle and other general issues of toxicology. And that website's sort of been overtaken by Toxipedia. And one of our projects this year is try to incorporate small dose into the Toxipedia website.
Great. What about let's see, IPMOpedia.org?
So IPMOpedia.org is an integrated pest management site.
Oh, okay.
And that is about looking at pesticides and how to use less pesticides to grow healthy vegetation, healthy plants. And that's been a very fun site. We were funded by King County to work on that site, and we got some other funding for that, which has been great. And it's in all these sites, these are the wiki-based sites. We're always looking for contributors to that. And it's got information, wide range of information on pesticide. But the real focus is how to grow plants and animals and plants and vegetation without using pesticides. And it's got information, for example, we just put a section up on green gardening, how to grow vegetable gardening plants with without using pesticides, when to harvest them. So really trying to promote less pesticide use, having a sustainable environment without using pesticides, or limiting very much the use of pesticides. Different techniques for that. Different, you can identify your pests on that, or identify plants. We've got a lot of pictures. It's a very interactive site. Very fun site.
Hmm. So how about, let's see, is it W-I-T-O-X?
W, World Library of Toxicology?
W-L-T-O-X.org.
So the World Library of Toxicology was funded by the National Library of Medicine, and this is a site that has country correspondents from around the world that put up information about toxicology issues in their country. For example, if you were traveling to Africa, say Nigeria, you go to that site and find out what government organizations that work on toxicology issues, some of the individuals associated with it, and what the prime toxicology issues were in that country. You can also, there's a big site for the U.S., of course, find out where the EPA is and FDA. You can go to England. You can sort of travel the world and look at toxicology issues and know that this site is being managed by experts in those countries that you're looking at.
Have you ever been referenced as a toxicology nerd?
Yeah, I am a little bit. I do see the world as a toxicologist. Like, for example, is it a dose response? Toxicology tells us about what's the dose and what's the response. So caffeine, what's the dose? We manage our response. So right now, all your listeners are getting a dose of me. And what's the response? It's a toxicology issue. Dose response.
Yeah, does this, all this stuff that you know and all your knowledge, does this often scare people? Or do some people think you're quite intense about all this stuff?
Yeah, I have been accused of being too intense about it before. And I do like what I do and do get carried away sometimes with it.
I love it.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's exactly how I am about the podcast and stuff.
Yeah,
and
that's good.
Just as you were talking about how you thought it was really important to have all of this stuff resourced and everything with all your writings and everything, that's actually the intention. Excuse me. The intention of the podcast is to provide resources to folks like yourselves and like-minded people. So let's see, how about healthyworldtheater.org?
So Healthy World Theater was one of our sites that we came up with, trying to unite the arts and sciences to forge a more healthy and peaceful world. Because a couple of us got tired of, we put a lot of science out there, but how do we think about this stuff in a more fun way? How do we have jokes about it, haiku? For example, how many toxicologists does it take to change a light bulb?
How many is it?
Oh, we're not sure. It depends. Does it have mercury in that filament? It might take a hazmat team, might have to go someplace. We don't know. We need to know the answers to these questions. So we try to put together a site that brings together plays, poetry, jokes, haiku, all kinds of comics, all kinds of things about toxicology or science in general, but try to make it fun and interesting.
It's the hippy-dippy scientist, huh?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. Try to have some fun with this subject, because otherwise it gets a little bit too depressing.
Well, we like hippy-dippy, and as somebody, Rebecca West from Rivoli Design, calls it woo-woo. So we like that here.
That's good.
So I noticed that you have a twitter.com/toxipedia, and what kind of stuff do you tweet about?
I usually tweet about once a day, and I usually tweet about some toxicological historical thing that's happened. I tweeted about Triangle Shortwave's fire recently, death of somebody or the birth of somebody that's interesting in toxicology history. So it's just sort of interesting factoids about toxicology.
Are you finding that there's an interest for it out there? Are you getting some people?
I get some people, some followers for it. I'm not sure how interesting people find it. But also it fits with our website, Toxipedia, because it has a history section on it.
Cool. So what descriptive words do you feel work best with people that have the most impact or really get through to people? For instance, in my line of work as a painting contractor, words such as green, eco, et cetera, is something that I use, are fairly commonplace. How about with you?
That's an interesting question. I come back, I think, to child health. You know, what are we doing to make sure our children can be healthy and have a healthy environment? So child health is sort of my, you know, the sort of touchstone and where I come back to and what I bring out for people. You know, are we protecting children? Like, I have a granddaughter, and when she comes in the house, it's wash your hands. You know, wash your hands, wash your hands. But the most important thing you do is wash your hands.
And kids do not do that.
They don't like doing that, but she's gotten really good about it. Yeah. So it's wash, wash, wash. So we bring her in there. When she comes in before she eats, that's wash her hands. And, you know, she's gotten used to it. You know, bring out the washcloth, wash her hands off. But she's pretty good about it.
Yeah, when I came up with the name, I talked about it. I probably will talk about it again on the podcast. When I came up with the name Healthy Painting, it was really important to me. It just, the green and the eco and stuff like that stuff seems, you know.
I like the notion of healthy painting. That's a great idea.
So what does a healthy home or a healthy being mean to you?
You know, healthy home means that the residents are being thoughtful about the products they're using and the conditions within the home. You know, they're thinking about taking their shoes off and walking the house. They're thinking about the paint they use. They're trying to use cleaning products with low toxicity. They're really being thoughtful about the environment. They have rugs in the home. They're vacuuming carefully. They're thinking about, you know, trying to buy products with least amount of toxic material in them. They're thinking about what they buy and the impact on the world. And I, you know, so that's sort of what I think about with all that.
And then what about a healthy being?
So a healthy being is sort of the same thing. You know, what we're exposed to, what we eat. Are we trying to eat, you know, more organic foods? Are we thinking about how much meat we eat? Do we really need to eat that much meat? Are we thinking about the subsidies, the farm subsidies out there, which has turned our whole food industry upside down? Are we thinking about the workplace exposures that we might have? Are we thinking about our occupational, our home, our school exposures for our children? Are people that are in home a lot, like elderly or young, what are they being exposed to? So it's really a matter of being thoughtful, looking around the outside environment, trying to reduce exposure to chemicals, you know, thinking about the green space, just being thoughtful. Because I think we all need to be thoughtful public health advocates. We need to be all advocating for our own health as well as the planet's health.
Mm. Yeah, so on the same lines, what does sustainability mean to you?
Sustainability means future generations, that we're not wiping out one species, we're not wiping out tuna or salmon, that we're creating an environment we can all live together and, you know, and enjoy each other's, you know, prosperity. So I think sustainability needs to look down, not just immediately, but look down for many generations down the road here. And we're not running our planet sustainably right now. We're an extraction economy, and we work on extracting things. We're wasteful of electricity we use. We are not conservation-oriented, and we need to be thinking more about that. Gas is too cheap. It's subsidized. Coal is subsidized. We need to have more sustainable energy. We need to put less carbon in the environment. We need to be thinking about where we're going as a world and what we're doing with the people we have. You know, we have too many people in the world. Are we thinking about that? Are we being thoughtful public health advocates?
Mm. So here's a question I try to throw out once in a while. When might something, I guess from a toxicology perspective or a health or a green perspective, when might something not appear to be safe or healthy on the surface, yet actually provide a responsible purpose?
Well, that's a tough question. What might
And
be...
I can give you an example.
Yeah, that'd be good. Help
there's a company up. Down in Portland, and by the way, I can't think of the name of them, but what they do is they take paint and instead of like disposing it or throwing it out or whatever, they mix it all together and you only get a variety of colors and stuff. But it's certainly by no means healthy paint, but it is being reused instead of disposed of. Is there any other examples or...
Well, what comes to mind right away is the recycling industry. you know, the electronic products recycling, which I think is really important, where they're trying to break these products down, despite industries not designing them to be disposed of. So I think we've got a real disconnect here that industry is not designing products, and they could easily design products to be dismantled and recycled and disposed of. So we have an industry out there that, you know, it's a fairly dirty industry that's trying to recycle products that are not made, not constructed to be recycled. And I think the other area I would think about that is pharmaceuticals. You know, drugs that we don't use, all of us probably have drugs in our bathroom or kitchen cabinets that were not used that are expired. What do we do with those? And that is an industry that needs to be moved along, where we should be able to take those back to the pharmacy or other areas, easily leave them off to be recycled. But right now, we don't have a good approach to recycling those products. I think of the recycling industry when you ask me that question.
Mm. Yeah, they say a lot of those household chemicals, people end up flushing them down their toilets, and then it gets into the water systems and stuff, and that causes a lot of issues.
It does, because, you know, our water systems, our sewage treatment plants are made to mostly treat bacteria, you know, fecal matter and things like that. They're not set up to treat chemical products. I want to take a quick moment. Can I mention another one of my websites?
Of course you can.
So I have another website called the Washington Nuclear Museum and Education Center. And I know nuclear issues have been a thing called, it's called WAMNEC, WANMEC.org. So that site focuses on Hanford, where we put a lot of information about Hanford. We're partly funded by the Department of Ecology, and we've got a lot of information about health effects of radiation on that site. And we just produced a book called Particles on the Wall, which looks at issues of science. It mixes science factoids with poems and visual arts about Hanford. So I think Hanford is another uniquely Washington feature that's the most contaminated site in the Western Hemisphere that we're spending billions of dollars to clean up that came out because of plutonium production for the Cold War. And we need to look at the legacy of the problems that we've created. And I want to remind all your listeners that 20 miles from Seattle is in Bremerton is the Bangor submarine base. It probably has one of the largest concentration of nuclear weapons in the world sitting just 20 miles from Seattle.
And wow, I did not know that.
I know. Isn't that an amazing fact? Most people don't know that. And we need to be thinking about it, because what triggered me was sustainability. These things are not sustainable. We cannot keep producing products like that. Hanford was an unsustainable operation that contaminated enormous amounts of land, and they're cleaning it up, trying to clean it up, and they've got decades worth of cleaning to do. And that, just the same with Japan, Fukushima. Mm. It's going to be decades before they get that site cleaned up. Just like what happened at Chernobyl. The anniversary of Chernobyl is coming up on April 26th. Chernobyl contaminated enormous amounts of ground.
Wow, that's next week. So yeah,
it is. Just coming right up next week.
So is that nuclear weapon you said that was over there on Bremerton?
Bremerton.
Is that an active?
It's a Bangor submarine base. It's where the big submarines come and go.
Yeah, sure. Is that an active weapon?
It's active. Those are active weapons. They also have storage sites for other, you know, sort of unused nuclear weapons that they're sort of keeping in reserve. Yeah. Although the New START treaty was just passed, which was a great effort. I really applaud Obama for doing that, but it's a very small step toward really scaling back nuclear weapons use. And we really need to think about scaling back our military, because that's another area, and we shouldn't get into that, but, you know, it really needs to be scaled back. And the military has done a terrible job with protecting the environment.
Yeah, well, also Obama, before this Japan incident, he's been an advocate for building more plants and stuff.
Right.
So he's been throwing out a lot of mixed messages when it comes to nuclear.
Very much. Say, you know, some people think nuclear needs to be a mix, but I think we really need to be thinking carefully about that, because Wall Street and the capitalist society says that nuclear plants are not viable. They do not want to invest the money unless it's backed by government loan guarantees. And why should the government be backing things that our capitalist society does not have faith in?
Hmm. So on a toxicology perspective, or just on a general perspective from your own heart, what helpful hints or wise advice do you have to share with people that has significant meaning to you?
That's a great question. So I have four things that I would recommend people do. One, wash your hands, because the world is covered with a very thin layer of bad stuff. And the next thing I do is take off your shoes when you come in your home. Always take off your shoes. And then I would say, be careful of your nutrition. Eat a broad, you know, well-balanced diet. And the final thing is walk. We all need to walk more. We need to walk to the store, walk to where we can go, You know, we need to walk half an hour, 45 minutes a day, walk to work when possible. We need to walk more. You don't need to have any sophisticated exercise program. That would help. You can do more exercise, but it's walking. So wash your hands, take off your shoes, have a good diet, you know, not a lot of sugar, limit the sugar, eat your vegetables, and walk.
Mm. Yeah, and when you wash your hands, to not use the that kind of soap that will break down your immune system.
Right, don't use antibiotics in the soap. Just use regular soap and water. No antibiotics in the soap, please. And of course, you got to be thinking about the products you buy. I mean, I think that would be sort of the fifth thing, is buy products that are green and sustainable, that are having the lowest footprint you can on the environment. And use less stuff. Conserve stuff. We're enormously gluttonous society, whether it's the food we eat or the products we use.
Yeah, that's all great advice. Yeah, the thing is, when it comes to recycling, people think it's so fantastic, but the truth of the matter is much of the recycling could be potentially certainly hands down more detrimental than it would be to conserve in the first place, and to be careful about what you buy.
Yeah, Daryl, you're absolutely right. We need to be thoughtful about what we buy, we need to be thoughtful about what we throw out, but if we bought less, we'd throw out a lot less.
Oh, yeah. And the thing I like, what you say about the walking, I know that there was a study done, I think it was on some military personnel over several decades, that people that walked, like I think it was like 30 or 40 minutes a day, the length of life and the quality of their life was it was like really, really extended.
Yeah, you don't need to do much, but walking is really important. You know, it's great for the bones, it's great for the muscles, it's great for circulation, it's good for everything. It's good for the environment. It's a good thing to do. Walk, 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 walk.
So putting a little, is it levity or brevity that's lightening up the situation?
Levity.
Okay, levity, okay. I'm not that edumacated.
Yeah, neither am I.
But putting a little levity on the situation with the walking and stuff, what do you do for fun in your life?
I walk and I bicycle. Bicycling. Cool. Yeah, so I enjoy bicycling, and truth be known, you probably heard from my interview, I love my work. I have great fun with the work I do, so I'm very happy working. You know, my wife says, "What are you doing?" "I'm working." "You're working?" But I like my work. I like what I do, and I enjoy
I can tell that, and I like your work too, and I like, that's how I am about the podcast. You know, I used to be a lot more active with stuff, and now it's kind of like more like on this and stuff, and it's still completely social, and it's different fun way. And exciting.
Yeah, I think what you're doing is really fantastic. I really like this idea.
Yeah, well, thanks. I mean, thanks for, first of all, I feel grateful for having the opportunity to be able to present something like this, and then having folks like yourself come and contribute to it. Aside from the stuff that we'd mentioned throughout the interview so far, what groups or organizations do you what other groups or associations do you support or are you affiliated with in your life?
Well, one of the big ones, I do a lot of work with the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. Mm. I think the Physicians for Social Responsibility do a great job. They cover a number of issues, from nuclear issues, from abolition of nuclear weapons to nuclear power plants. They work on environmental quality issues. They work on food issues. So it's a really great organization. I think the physicians have a lot to say. I've been the past president of their board of directors. I sit on the national board of Physicians for Social Responsibility. I think, and also locally, is the Washington Toxics Coalition. I sit on their board of directors. They're really important in moving legislative issues forward. People for Puget Sound does a great job. WashPerg, and another group that more of a communications group is Resource Media, which is they have a big office here in Seattle. So there's a lot of different people that work very hard in this group, and I really encourage people to engage your local nonprofits that are working on these issues. Quote-unquote non-governmental organizations. And it's also really important to engage our legislative folks. I encourage all your listeners to go talk to their legislative folks. Talk to your legislator, whether it's your city council person, your state representatives. Get to know them. They listen to you. You have a very important voice. I think it's very important that we get out there and engage our representatives and tell them what we think. Tell them how important it is that we protect human and environmental health and that you want a safe environment. You want a safe environment for your kids. You want to make sure your kids can reach, maintain their full potential. And they are responsible for that stuff. And they can do a lot to change policy and regulation that will improve our environment.
So I think we touched on the social media thing a little bit with the Twitter. I think there's so much, maybe this question is a little redundant. We will put the information all on our onto the site. Is there any, like, one or just a couple specific websites or phone numbers or Facebook or Twitter or blogs or whatever that you really want to encourage people to check out?
Well, of course, check out my own. Toxopedia has a Facebook page. I think that the most exciting project that we worked on, we've just started a press, Healthy World Press. You can look at healthyworldpress.org. We published our first book, as I mentioned, Particles on the Wall. It's out as an ebook. We're working on some other projects called, one of them is Particles of E-Waste. We plan on doing a series of books around Particles of, that again tries to bring in the arts and sciences together. And I would look at, I would just look at some of the government websites. I think, you know, you can Google information, but, you know, that's not, Google is not the be-all and end-all to information searching. So I think you need to find sites you trust. Our goal with Toxopedia was to make a site people could trust and branch out from. But there's a lot of information out there. I think our challenge, and we know how to do research. I think our society has really mastered how to learn more and more about less and less and do research. The academic environment is great at that. Business is good at that. But what we don't invest in is making information accessible, connecting the dot with the information that's out there. And my own view is that we need to spend more resources making information accessible to the public so we make better decisions individually and collectively. And there's no one site that does that well. But to learn as much as you can, be aware. There's Environmental Health News is a good place. It sort of gives you a potpourri of different headlines around the world. And I think you just got to keep always, keep your eyes open and keep reading about as broadly as possible a different subject matter. But it's really hard. But we need policy change. We need change in policy. So my final recommendation, engage your go talk one-on-one with your legislative folk. Write editorials, write emails, write your legislative folks. Tell them what you think. They work for us. They are employed by us. Talk to them. Mm. Tell them what you think. Tell them you want change.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for all that. Are there any upcoming events or information or news or specials or anything that you have that you want to offer our listeners that we can post on our site?
I think I'm giving a talk coming up here on the 23rd. I think it's close to Earth Day at Revolution Books. I'm going to be talking about Fukushima and a little about radiation effects. And that's one thing coming up. I think to just look out, there'll be a number of things around Chernobyl's 25th anniversary. Watch out for that. And I think it's important just to get out and protest, get out and get active in the world. Go to some events that are out there. And I must say I don't keep, there's so many coming up sometimes that I don't keep good track of them. But I think there's some really good lists out there that put that stuff together. Here's a site you mentioned having sites. Here's one that just came to mind: the Collaborative Healthy Environment, CHE, and there's a CHE Washington. But search on the website Collaborative on Health in the Environment. A really great work. They have a great calendar that comes up of events coming out, of different podcasts and different ways that are all, most of them are free, different events that are coming up. There's one for CHE Washington. There's also one for CHE National.
What are the letters on that one again?
Collaborative on Health and the Environment, CHE.
.org?
.org.
Okay, cool.
But check out that. I think that's, broadly speaking, it's a really good site to pay attention to.
Well, wow, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. Any last words or anything that you feel was left out of the conversation?
I don't think so. I just want to thank you for what you're doing and thank you for taking the time and effort to do this. And I think it's really wonderful you're trying to help people understand these issues more. It's really great. I think that we have a long way to go to get the word out about these issues and help people understand. And again, I just want to encourage your audience to get out there, get active, tell your legislative folks we're a democracy, and you cannot sit on the sidelines in a democracy.
Amen. You're preaching to the choir here. Let's see. So that's it for episode 9 of Healthy Homecast. On behalf of Stephen Gilbert and myself, Daryl Whalen, we say thank you, and we'll catch you next time. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Healthy Homecast, brought to you by HealthyPainting.com. Please feel free to contact us with any comments, questions, or suggestions for upcoming show topics or guests. Call us at 206-650-4587 or send a direct email to info@HealthyHomecast.com. Be sure to check back. New episodes coming soon.
Desert.